Morning, everybody.
Morning.
I would like to introduce our guest speaker. Our guest speaker is traveling the world speaking about his new book, and he decided to stop in and see us on his way to some exotic place. I don't know. So, I don't think I wanted it. This is Ben Connolly's third book. He's going to be talking about it today, and he's going to be staying after during tea to sign copies for people who would like copies. I highly recommend it. It combines two components, mindfulness from the very beginning of our tradition, the Pali canons, and intimacy from Mahayana Soto Zen, which our teachers taught us. So they didn't really even talk about intimacy. They just lived it. They just lived it. So Ben has done a very artful job of weaving those two together and showing how our practice manifests those two. And he's got practical chapters on friendship, sex and romance, community, and many, many other things. So.
Thank you, Tim.
Stick around for a while.
I would like to. I appreciate the invitation. So thanks, Tim. And Tim has to step out. He stayed for the first talk, so we won't subject him to it twice. So thank you very much, and I'm really grateful to be here. This is a wonderful opportunity, and I've been so supported. You know, I started Zen practice. I think I sat there. It was a Thursday morning. And I sat there, and it was really quiet, and I felt really inspired and touched, and then people started chanting, and I ran out the door. So, things have changed. Now I'm the one freaking people out by chanting. So, anyway, this place has been such a wonderful support for my own path of healing and liberation, and it's doing it with you all. So I'm really grateful. So I'm going to jump into talking about this book. I'm just going to read a couple really short sections here. First, I'm going to read essentially how I define mindfulness, just the first chapter of the first paragraph of the chapter on mindfulness. Mindfulness is being aware of things in the present moment in a way that promotes well-being. To practice mindfulness is to choose some aspect of our experience and focus attention there in a sustained way. There is discernment in mindfulness, but it is non-judgmental. It is kind. It allows the mind to rest in the phenomena of the present moment and take a break from creating a relentless stream of imaginations about the future, reviews of the past, or judgments of the present. Our awareness is one of the most amazing and powerful things we have as human beings. Rather than taking it for granted and allowing it to focus wherever the mind's habits choose, with mindfulness we can better focus awareness on things that are truly beneficial. So, and what I just like to say here is, like, mindfulness is an object-based practice. So it's based in the idea that you choose an object that is other than yourself and you look at it, which is wonderful. We use the tendency of our mind to believe that there are objects that are separate from ourselves in order to dissolve the sense that there are objects that are separate from ourselves. And that dissolving opens us up to intimacy. I'll read a paragraph about intimacy. Intimacy, in its simplest definition, means close familiarity and friendship. Words, however, have power and meaning beyond their definitions. No matter what the dictionary says, some words evoke very different meanings or feelings to different people. To some folks, the word religion evokes inspiration, warmth, and wonder. To others, constriction and close-mindedness. And I'm pretty sure both classes of people are in this room, having talked to quite a few of you. So, intimacy is a word a bit like this. It can evoke feelings of connection and safety. But for some people, it's pretty scary or stickily sentimental. And then there are the folks who think it just means sex. why are you here? Is anyone... Okay. So here I will be pointing towards a way of understanding and experiencing the word intimacy that fosters compassion, calm, and joyful action. I use intimacy here as we often use it in Zen discourse. It's about harmony between autonomy and interdependence. In intimacy, we are individuals who are connected, and we are also one undivided whole. We can develop both healthy boundaries and healthy boundarylessness. And this healthy boundaries and healthy boundarylessness is the essential theme of the book. So mindfulness is a boundary practice where we say there's something I'm looking at with discernment. Intimacy is about shedding boundaries and seeing through the conceptions of our mind that make things seem like separate things. And so intimacy here... One way to put it is intimacy is how things are. So because everything, from my viewpoint and the viewpoint of Mahayana literature and actually all Buddhist literature, everything arises due to infinite conditions. That means everything is already completely intimate with everything else. So intimacy isn't like something that happens in one context or that you have or own or we kind of feel it. We have a sense of it. But ultimately, the intimacy I'm talking about is a condition of things as they are in any given moment. So I write about this for a variety of reasons. I chose these themes and this topic for this book for a variety of reasons. One is that we have, I don't know if you've heard, but mindfulness is kind of trendy. Yes. I mean, I remember reading a book about mindfulness about 15 years ago by Thich Nhat Hanh, and it was like, mind blown, whoa, amazing. And then little did I know that 10 years later I would go to the grocery store and find a mindful coloring book right next to the Twix bars. So things change, and things change very fast. This is not a, I haven't actually tracked this, but I read a lot of wellness articles, in various publications, and I would guess half of them mention that you should either become mindful, do mindfulness training, meditate, or they describe something as a way to be well, which is a mindfulness practice, but don't call it that. I mean, it's just like sweeping through the discourse of our culture. So this is hopefully good, there's a real danger, I think. There are a variety of dangers to this. I mean, one is that it starts to look like we have kind of an idea that we should be involved in self-improvement. You know, they're called self-help books. In fact, I was amazed to find this book is categorized somewhere. Oh, maybe it's on some web page. It's a self-help book. Oh, well. What can I do? I'm beyond genres, man. Anyway, self-improvement. So mindfulness is fundamentally was not designed to be a self-improvement practice. It was intended to be something that allowed you to see through the illusion of the existence of a self so you could open up to radical and totally intimacy with everything so that your life energy just flows for the liberation of everyone. So as we start to see the tendency to view things from a very individualistic, self-centered perspective in our culture, we see mindfulness being swept and embedded into this framing. And so I think as people who are involved in this culture, we have a place in trying to help people see that mindfulness is about something beyond that. And, you know, in particular, you see critiques of the mindfulness movement where people are like, yeah, I went to the corporation I work at is like requires me to go to mindfulness training. And I do things where people, you know, I've like work with a police department where they have to go and hang out with me. The chief says go and then you have to go. And so I've been involved in things where people are required to do mindfulness training. Now when I'm doing it, I say, I can't control your mind. You can do whatever you want. You know, if I'm giving mindfulness training to someone, all I can do is give them some invitations. Regardless, I'm on a tangent. the train of thought is, people say, oh, I went to my corporation says I have to go to the mindfulness training, and the corporate environment I'm in is profoundly unhealthy, and they're just like telling me to just like learn how to chill out and relax and be with what is, and they're like, I'm not really sure that's helpful. This is a reasonable critique. So if mindfulness becomes something, I don't know if you guys are familiar with Karl Marx, who I really didn't plan to quote right now, but he did say religion is the opiate of the masses. So if we allow Buddhism, which provides a vision of universal liberation, to just be subsumed into the culture in a way that just makes people opiated and willing to accept the conditions that we're in, I don't think that's helpful at all. Because we live in a culture that is massively harmful. This is the basic teaching of Buddhism, and it's what I perceive. We have enormous environmental degradation. Species are becoming extinct at an incredibly rapid rate. Environments are changing in ways that are incredibly harmful to the people and all the wildlife. We live in a culture that is white supremacist. We live in a culture that is patriarchal. We live in a culture where transphobia, homophobia, ableism, and ageism are incredibly prevalent. And I'm not even beginning to list all the things we could think about. So these things are all happening. So I'm totally not interested in having people learn to just be like, yeah, I accept it all. This is a practice that's about realizing we have liberative capacity in every moment. So another thing about this book is like one of my students came to me a while ago. He said, you know, I like the meditation. It's good, but I'm really more called toward the bodhisattva thing. So I'm focused on volunteering. And if you look at the literature of this Mahayana tradition from which these practices come, when we practice zazen, that is for the liberation of all beings. And when we eat soup, we eat soup for the liberation of all beings. Listen to the liturgy that we chant before we eat. I receive this food as medicine to sustain my life so that I can be a liberative force. When we work in the garden, when we listen to a friend, when we show up at a meeting and say, no, what you're doing is harmful, all that can be practice. And we can do it by realizing that we have the ability to cultivate both mindfulness and intimacy in every one of those situations. An awareness of what we should be paying attention to and how, that's mindfulness, and an awareness that whatever divisions we have in our mind are not ultimately real. Audre Lorde once wrote, without community, there is no liberation. What kind of liberation is it within the framework of Buddhist thought? If you're like, I'm free, I don't have any negative emotional states. And then it's like, good luck, everybody. So you're free of greed and hatred, but you're subsumed in delusion. Because the fundamental delusion of this tradition is that there can be separation, that there can be freedom without community. So, all this material that I'm talking about is pretty rooted in Yogacara, Vasubandhu's vision of Yogacara. And I didn't start with that because my last book was called Inside Vasubandhu's Yogacara, and I would say the title, then people would go, oh yeah, I gotta go. So, anyway, I wanted to write a book that was about the same thing but had a title that made you go, oh, intimacy, that sounds good. Well, actually, a bunch of people are probably like, intimacy. But I'll talk about that later. So anyway, Vasubandhu's vision is one that integrates early Buddhist, as Tim said, his perspicacious reading of the book, it integrates early Buddhist Theravadan emphasis on using mindfulness to diminish afflictive emotional reactivity, and then Mahayana teachings that emphasize interdependence, non-duality, and going beyond our conceptual separations. So So one more theme of this book is that people's capacity to be mindful and intimate, but here I'm going to emphasize intimate, people's capacity to be realize intimacy, I should say, is very state dependent. So people in certain contexts in their lives, they'll really feel their connection and their sense of feeling separate and cut off will be diminished. And then there are other contexts where they tend to feel very alienated, separate, needing to control, and so forth. So, for example, I was talking to someone who's in this room, but I won't name him because that would be weird. But anyway, I was like, yeah, you know, a lot of people realize intimacy really deeply in nature, right? So just picture yourself out in the mountains. I do retreats with people in the mountains. I see a lot of my friends who've been out there. We go in the mountains, and we're just standing there watching the water rush down the creek, and we're just flowing. It's like we're flowing with the flowing, and then there are birds, and we open up. You know, or maybe you just go for a walk in the park, and you look at the trees, and you feel a connection. That's why I was talking about this sort of thing with someone yesterday. And he said, well, I don't really like nature. My favorite part was a nature walk is okay every few years. So anyway, that's how we are, right? How many people in this room are like, intimacy, when I'm in the bosom of my family, that's when I feel just connected and whole, and I feel like, and then I'm kind of guessing there might be some people here who don't have that feeling. Yes. Yeah. That's real. Or I'll take, for example, Prince, the musician. Prince Rogers Nelson. So Prince, if you watch him play music, the sense of absorption in the activity of music making is profound. And you just see this sort of person disappearing into something larger. And if you... I was very foolish and never went and saw Prince perform, partly because it was always like, yeah, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, drive out to Paisley Park. Come on, man. I got Zazen at 5. Anyway. So I know many people have described the experience, and I've watched movies and videos. I think I watched Purple Rain. I worked at the movie theater, and we had 9 screenings. I watched 8. Anyway. But when watching him perform, you would see thousands of people being elevated into his profound sense of intimacy by the performance, by his subsuming himself so completely in the activity. A profound spiritual experience that people would have and describe. Amazing. And yet, Prince died alone in an elevator of a drug overdose. So sometimes having this amazing capacity to do this is actually paired with huge holes in our ability to feel and recognize our intimacy and to be healed and whole. Talking about this, I think, is just valuable for any person who wants to be free. But I think it is particularly important to talk about in the context of Zen centers, where you meet people who have profound abilities to open up into the whole. But we've seen many, many cases of people who not only could do this, but could help other people find it and help other people connect with that intimacy, but who also had profound, profound lack of awareness in how much harm they did when they were, for example, having sex with their students or abusing power in any other ways. So by recognizing that intimacy alone, without mindfulness, there's a very dangerous potential for a lack of growth in certain areas. So this book is really about looking at, we can look through many, many aspects of our life, and we can be like, oh, here's a place where I tend to pay attention to what's beneficial in a way that's beneficial, or not. And here's a place where I tend to be aware of connection and be more open. And here's a place where I'm very shut down and alienated feeling. And then it allows for practices that can, where we can open and transform, build on where we are naturally capable, and heal where we have patterns of harm. So I'm going to read a little something here. Whoa. Impermanence is real, folks, because either I need some different glasses or something is wrong with this book. So this is a chapter that's dedicated to mindfulness of emotional states. Have you ever seen someone laughing in the rain, or someone stoop-shouldered, shuffling along on a green and sunny day? Perhaps in a time of crisis, you've seen someone respond with resolve and energy, and someone else collapse into fear or despair. Maybe someone you know gets testy, and then you know it's best to leave them alone. When a loved one is dying, sometimes people are overwhelmed with pain and can barely take care of their basic needs. And sometimes they leap into frantic action to avoid their feelings. And at other times, they only know one thing: profound, all-encompassing acceptance and love. I've seen all this in others and in myself as well. One of the clearest insights of my years of meditation is how powerfully my emotions color my experience, my perception of the world. When I am angry, I feel isolated. I feel the need to control, the need for swift action. When sad, I feel alone, like there's nothing worth doing. I feel like staying in bed. When I'm afraid, I feel vulnerable, like I have to get away. When I am ashamed, I feel abandoned, like everything is pointless and like I am fundamentally flawed. When I feel intimacy with people in my environment, on the other hand, I feel connected. I trust what's happening, and I am patient and engaged. Afflictive emotions are the reason the practice of mindfulness exists, and why the kind of intimacy this book is about arose as central to Buddhist thought. Buddhism is at its root a set of practices and ideas designed to free human beings from afflictive emotion. So, the teachings on mindfulness in this book are derived from the classic central text on mindfulness, which is the Four Foundations of Mindfulness Sutra from the Pali Canon, also known as the Satipatthana Sutta. And that sutra is kind of complicated. If you've read it, sometimes you'd be like, wow, the lists are long and I have to pay attention to all this stuff. And actually, I think it would be really great if you did. Or maybe even if I did. Because I haven't, you know, there are people who devote their whole lives to just manifesting the mindfulness in the Satipatthana Sutta. I've spent some time with it. But I, having studied it a bit and then really looked at how Vasubandhu, who I cited earlier, looks at how this practice can be brought into our lives, I have a simple formula, which is, first, be aware of the body and the senses. And my hope is that you're here at this Zen Center and you hear this over and over again, and we slowly settle into it. And it's good to hear it over and over again, but I'm not going to emphasize it right now. The second principal emphasis I'll recommend for mindfulness is mindfulness of emotional states. Being aware of whatever emotion is here in the present moment. Mindfulness has a what and a how. The what is the object that you've chosen to attend to, and the how is the quality of awareness towards which you direct it. So what here is how you feel, and how with mindfulness is with compassionate, non-judgmental presence. Just over and over developing your ability to be like, this is how I feel, and I'm here for it. I care enough to pay attention. Audre Lorde, the great womanist scholar once wrote, "The quality of light by which we scrutinize our lives has a direct bearing on the product which we live and the changes which we hope to bring about through those lives." The quality of light by which we scrutinize our lives has a direct bearing on the product which we live and on the changes which we hope to bring about through those lives. So we are so conditioned to believe that we should always be focused on manipulating things. And then finally we go, oh, I'll do some introspection. And then it's like, ooh, let me mess with this. Right? Always making an object and trying to manipulate it. But the quality of light, this is powerful. To just practice seeing ourselves honestly, non-judgmentally, and compassionately, profoundly transformative, over and over again. So I want to read another little section. This section is about Tomoe Katagiri. So Tomoe, who some of you know, the lucky ones. So this place was founded as a temple by Dainin Katagiri. And his wife, Tomoe, came with him when they moved here to found the temple. Tomoe is noted for many things, but one is for being the first person to have taught and transmitted the sewing of Zen robes in the United States. It's possible at some point someone will say, no, we found someone else. But as far as I know, that is true. And I'm just, this may sound like I'm advertising my own thing, but I wrote an article in Tricycle Magazine, a profile of Tomoe, and I really encourage people to go look at it. I was able to interview many people who had studied with and had been inspired by her. I managed to interview her, and she gave amazing teachings. And so it's wonderful. Anyway, I'm just going to tell you something about Tomoe. This is a chapter called Teachers. Tomoe Katagiri taught me well, mostly by staying by my side and quietly pouring her energy into what we were doing together. Tomoe-san helped bring the art of Zen sewing, the art of sewing Zen monks' robes from Japan to the United States. And she was my teacher in sewing the robes that symbolized my ordination. She gave me precise instruction on the technical aspects of sewing, with which I am far from adept. But to me, her real teaching lay in her embodiment of patience, attention to the present moment, and quiet, warm intimacy. It was not uncommon, as we worked side by side, for us to be silent for an hour at a time to support wholehearted focus on each stitch. After the entire robe is sewn, which took me about a year, it is carefully ironed and folded precisely. Ironed and folded. Like origami. I frequently found the sewing process frustrating. And how? I didn't write that in the book, but I'll tell you, it was really true. I frequently found the sewing process frustrating, and she just calmly stitched away beside me. I recall the moment when I finished the final stitch, a moment I had been waiting for. I said, Tomoe, I finished the robe. I was ready for a birthday cake, or maybe some fireworks. She put down her sewing and moved to stand up as she said, I'll turn on the iron. Zen teachers. Sometimes they don't give you a cookie. I don't think she was consciously teaching me, but she brought me right back to what was in front of me. She modeled not living for some other time when the current task, the current manifestation of life, is done. She hadn't been waiting for me to finish, and she realized nothing is ever really finished. Life goes on. All things connect. She took care of the world by focusing on the life at hand, and that was teaching enough for me. So this is our... the Zen tradition, the literature of it, is principally just one person talking to another. One person talking to another. Amazing. The liberative power of this activity is very great. So in recovery, in the 12-step tradition, they say Recovery from addiction is just one drunk talking to another. And you can find millions of people who have experienced profound transformation through the direct commitment to intimacy. And in our tradition, what it says, you should be so intimate with your teacher that your eyebrows grow together. So, we can't shave our eyebrows, Ted. So, other things about teaching. So, I was at Hazelden. I teach at Hazelden Chemical Dependency Center occasionally, and I was up there doing just a big public talk at this Sunday event where lots of people come. And I just did a guided meditation, a little talk, Q&A, it's nice. And during the Q&A, someone said, oh, yeah, that was really interesting, and something came up for me, she said. I'm a therapist, and I teach mindfulness to all my clients. But I've never had any training in mindfulness, and I don't practice it myself. I'm not exaggerating. Wow! Talk about, like, my previous point about how this is being appropriated into our culture. What a trip. Now, the thing is, how hard is it to sit with someone and say, hey, just notice how you're breathing? How much training does a person need to do that? Not much. And yet, in this tradition, on the seat where I am, the expectation you have spent thousands and thousands of hours practicing meditation, studying the textual tradition. So I don't know. I don't know how this is going to work. But I do think it's worth just being aware that right now the process of how mindfulness is being appropriated into the culture is kind of wild. It's kind of wild. So, another thing I want to mention about teachers is wonderful intimacy, but in our tradition, we have a very clear kind of projection of power, and we have hierarchy. I'm actually sitting on a platform right now. What's up with that? Well, I have to admit, why we got the platform is because we felt bad for people who couldn't see in the back. That just seemed weird, like sit on the floor and there are people. But anyway, I am on a platform. What does that mean? There's a physical representation of power. And there are many other, like if you come to a sesshin, it's like the teacher just sits up in the hojo all day while everyone's down here in the zendo. So this is can be useful. I mean, power is useful in human cultural forms, but it's perilous. It's perilous. Seems to be extra perilous when you have men involved. Oh, and they seem to have so much of it. Huh. Anyway, many people have abused the power that is invested in them in this position like where I'm sitting. And so just recognizing that and being true about it is really important if we want to make a way for this practice to be liberative for everyone going forward. It brings to mind a quotation from an amazing person named Ida Wells. Ida Wells was a journalist, and she basically, what she's famous for is saying, we are going to actually we're going to do journalism on and let people know about lynchings. There were lots of lynchings, but the newspapers were like, oh, we don't really need to mention that. I was like, yeah, so a mob of white people just killed somebody, and that's not newsworthy. So it took a lot of effort on her part to say, no, we are going to let people know this is happening. She once said, the way to right wrongs is to turn the light of truth upon them. The way to right wrongs is to turn the light of truth upon them. And she said that in this particular context where she worked. But what's amazing about it is also it has a much more broad and profound wisdom. So it matters exactly what she's talking about. Also, from the perspective of the Buddhist tradition, what wrong? There's harm. We live in samsara. We live within a massive pattern where people suffer because of the way they think and the way they act. And you can do something about it. And so then as I said to my friend who he just converted to Judaism, he said, let's get together and talk about our traditions. And so he was telling me it was really cool. And then I was like, well, he's like, what about yours? And I'm like, well, you know, I come from this tradition where the idea is in every moment you have liberative capacity. Every single moment you can do something beneficial. And he's like, oh, that sounds like a lot of pressure. So then I, oh, wow, that's inspiring to me, but oh, interesting. So the thing is, the way to right wrongs is to turn the light of truth upon them. The broader wisdom that I'm bringing here is, within Buddhist thought, you have liberative capacity, and the answer isn't to run frantically around trying to change things. It's to focus on how you're using your awareness and the quality of your action, so that your action could be transformed to come from a place that wants to liberate everyone, and with a wisdom that knows how to do that. So I'm just going to do one more little reading here. The ending of this book, we have a chapter, there's a series of chapters. One's called The Ones We Love. The next one's called The Ones We Don't Know, which I'm going to read you from. And the one after it is called, I spent a lot of time deciding how I wanted to put this, The Ones We Don't Like. There's some other terms that could come in. Anyway. Many old Buddhist teachings say that seeing our interdependence is seeing reality. Is seeing truth. And not seeing it is ignorance. Seeing interdependence is truth. Not seeing it is ignorance. Ignorance basically means not knowing. If you think about all the things you don't know, how many pins are in your pincushion? How many stars are in the sky? How many people are laughing within a mile of you right now? And how many are crying? How things are for each of the approximately 40 trillion bacteria living as part of your body? I looked it up. I don't have the patience to count that high. Where you left your umbrella? What's going on in Yemen right now or on Mars? You get the idea. We're pretty ignorant. It's all right. Let's start there. Let's just take a moment to be intimate with the vastness of our ignorance. Like a great ocean of not knowing. Do you know what each of the billions of fish in the sea are experiencing right now? Intimacy with this not knowing situation can open the door for a deeper sense of our interdependence and connection to what we can't know, but we are already a part of. Usually we ignore what we don't know. The human mind picks out a tiny, infinitesimal corner of reality and tries to figure it out, and then spends a lot of time feeling like it's got a handle on things. Really, it's ignoring infinite things to give itself a tenuous sense of security in the vastness of this wild, unfurling world. If we practice mindfulness of our body, mind, and heart, we can begin to see the process by which the mind constructs this small picture of the world. We see that our awareness moves between a broad, spacious sense and a constricted, narrow view based on how our body, mind, and heart are interacting. If we practice objectless meditation, like Zazen, the mind's categorizing slows down, and we tend to actually experience gaps in the mind's tendency to actively ignore most of what's happening. We find ourselves occasionally resting in a total non-differentiated awareness. While we will always remain in a kind of ignorance about the infinite aspects of the universe, we can diminish the degree to which we actively, though generally unconsciously, ignore things. This is the path by which we begin to see interdependence, to see a world that is not made of things to judge, control, and manipulate, but a world with which we are intimate and to which we can offer our best effort. Thank you. So that completes my holding forth on my own. And now we have time to welcome other voices, voices of question, comment, challenge, celebration, sorrow, however you are. Yes.
Ben, do you see Zazen and mindfulness as being different? I'm just going to hear saying that Zazen is objectless and mindfulness is object-based.
Kind of. So I talk about this in more detail in this book. So So in a way, yes. So I use the Yogacara differentiation. So mindfulness is object-based meditation fundamentally. And then Zazen, if we talk about Shikantaza, which we would call objectless meditation, we don't choose an object to focus on, nor do we have an object we're trying to achieve, right? So those are different, but the way we teach Zazen here uses what in the Yogacara text is called access to shamatha meditation, which is mindfulness of body. So we teach mindfulness of breath, and then we just generally teach people, as you establish awareness of breath, to let awareness to broaden so completely that there's no particular object, all held within a non-gaining idea. Thank you.
Can you say that what the we teach the what again? The you said a certain word there.
Access to shamatha. Shamatha is how, that's a confusing way to put it though, but access to objectless meditation would be a good way to put it.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Taylor.
You know, it's a shame you never got to see Prince play. It really is, because he was so present. And I would say from the eighth grade up until when he passed, his skill never improved at all. He didn't. He was just that good.
Wow.
Him, a guy named Andre Anderson, they call him Andre Simone, another guy named David Island, we call him Batman. He produced Terry and Jimmy, a lot of their stuff, and Janet Jackson. But those guys, they were, I don't know what they were, but they, he, when he, Prince was a better drummer than he was a guitar player. Mm. When he, whatever he picked up, he was just really, he became one with it. And he just took off. And he was someplace else. And then he would come back. And then he would just walk off stage.
Wow.
The guys would come in. Their shoes wasn't shined. He would shine their shoes. And teach them how to shine their shoes. And tell Chad, take off his shirt. Iron his shirt. This is how you iron your shirt. He was always instructing. But he was, he was just, he was really present, though. He was really hard, too.
Thank you, and I just love you said, I don't know what he was, yeah. And there's one of the first encounter, after Buddha's enlightenment, the first encounter he has is with a monk who says, what are you? He doesn't say, who are you? What are you?
I really like the talk. I find the concept of like intimacy and the relationship with mindfulness really interesting. One concern I did have, and I harped on this a few weeks ago, just like I find the like political thing kind of unhelpful, like with the social justice-y stuff, because like when we say that our society is white supremacist, it implies that there's like these like secret evil white supremacists among us. Like it creates this us and them dynamic.
Mm.
Like you have to be scared of this.
Oh yeah. Well, my point is that we're intimate with it, so it's in me. That's the whole point. That's why I talk about it. It's in me. Yeah. So. Yeah.
You know, fear of people we perceive as different from ourselves, as anything that we perceive as different from ourselves, like a rock falling on our head, it's hard to like to draw the line between like a legitimate introspection and sort of stoking of anxieties and fears, at least for me.
Mm. Yeah, well, that's a reasonable, you know, they say, afflict the comforted and comfort the afflicted.
Yeah.
I don't know where that comes from. That's not what I'm trying to do. But the thing is to be real, to just be real. And absolutely the point is not that there's some people out there like, how could I be talking about patriarchy? I'm sitting in this chair, right? So I'm acknowledging that there's something going on here that I get to work on, and I'm encouraging you to work on with me. And let's free everybody. That's what I'm talking about. Yeah.
This goes in a different direction from what you were saying, but there's something you said that
triggered thoughts for me. In the a number of years ago, I changed religions, and from like a very, very strong community-based, like family-based religious kind of environment where everything was kind of shaped by the religion. That had a really profound emotional impact on me that I hadn't really foreseen coming. Depression over a number of years, kind of my first personal experience with traumatic loss. As you were talking, I realized, oh, like the thing I lost was access to all of that intimacy.
Mm.
That being like my family being united in this worldview and being in this community of people who were united in this worldview gave really easy, ready access to intimacy all the time. And then the comment about how like we are predisposed to be afraid of things that are different from us made me recognize that the one, I'm sure there are many, but one of the reasons that we're afraid of them is because we're afraid that, whatever the difference is going to bar intimacy with that person or that those people or that school of thought.
Mm-hmm. I think that's really insightful, and it's a theme that I like to develop, that actually we are conditioned to seek intimacy, but in the process of seeking intimacy to make an other. So that's actually the normal conditioned way of having intimacy. We're like, this is my group, and you're not. This is my body, and you're not. So actually, that's why we have the idea of intimacy that's put in here, which is that it's how things are. So we can recognize that we can find intimacy that is not exclusionary. That's the vision of the Mahayana, of a boat, a vehicle in which we can get everybody, and we can all go towards realization. And we're all ourselves. We don't all suddenly become one thing. We're different. Without community, as Audre Lorde said, there is no liberation. But community must not mean a shedding of our differences. So, I think that's what I got for you. It's really wonderful to be with you this morning, to engage in what we can hope is a liberative practice, and I wish you all healing and power. Thank you.